What is going on, guys? This is Brendan Burns, and welcome to the Brendan Burns Show. Join me as I interview, dissect, and share the stories of high performers who have created the life that they deserve on their terms. I sit down with speakers, professional athletes, and successful entrepreneurs from all over the world who have chosen to live a life of fulfillment and joy over status and money. In each episode, I share actionable strategies that you can implement in your life, plus inspiration along the way. So come join me for this episode of The Brendan Burns Show. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of The Brendan Burns Show. Joining us today is Anthony Scaramucci, the founder and managing partner of SkyBridge, a global alternative investment firm, and founder and chairman of SALT, a global thought leadership forum and venture studio. Prior to founding SkyBridge in 2005, Scaramucci co-founded investment partnerships Oscar Capital Management, which was sold to Neuberger Berman in 2001. And before that, he worked in the private wealth management division of Goldman Sachs. Scaramucci served on President Donald Trump's 16-person presidential transition executive committee, and in 2017 served as chief strategy officer of the Export-Import Bank and White House communications director. Like me, Scaramucci is a native of Long Island, New York. He holds his Bachelor of Arts degree in econ from Tufts University, and he has a JD from Harvard Law. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Well, first of all, I love the theme music, and I love the start of the show. And Brendan, you didn't mention that I got fired from the White House, which means that you're a nice guy, but everybody knows I got fired from the White House, but that's cool. I love, you know, like my bio says, serve briefly as the communicator. And I got fired. I was there for 11 days. We were fighting like dogs. I got fired.
Yeah. And so I, just to kind of plead ignorance, I'm not a big politics guy. If you're okay kind of jumping into that first, I'd love to hear kind of your take on that.
Well, I mean, listen, it's 7 years ago now. I worked for Donald Trump during the campaign. I was a lifelong Republican. I had worked for Jeb Bush when it looked like Trump was going to win the nomination. I would say garden variety Republicans like me expected Trump to move towards us and become more garden variety instead of us moving towards him. But he is an astounding political figure, frankly, because he moved an entire party towards him. He turned a party of Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan into the party of Donald Trump. And so you have to think about how staggering that is. You have to think about how monumental that is. So I don't like him. I'll work against him to try to prevent him from becoming president again. I can explain what he was doing in the presidency that was very dangerous. I got fired, since you don't follow politics. The supposed story about why I got fired is I said something really nasty about Steve Bannon, which is probably not even age appropriate for your show. It got picked up on a hot mic. It got played on the New Yorker magazine. And so they quote unquote fired me for that reason. But the real reason I got fired was I was fighting with Donald Trump, and we were fighting about a number of different things. And he is a guy that was serving himself, and he was a guy that was not serving, in my mind or many people's minds, the American public. And so he fired me. And then shortly after I got fired, maybe 80 other people got fired or left because they found the same situation with him. And I'll just finish up this part of the conversation by saying that I have 40 friends that are cabinet officials, sub-cabinet officials, White House staffers, former communications directors who have all said the same thing. We will not endorse Donald Trump. We do not think he should get anywhere near the American presidency. And last but not least, the vice president of the United States, Mike Pence, the former vice president, has said under no circumstances would he endorse Donald Trump for the presidency. So we're all here. We're all ex-Trumpers. We're all dissidents. We're more garden variety mainstream Republicans. But again, he shifted that party towards him, not the other way around.
Yeah, that makes sense. I appreciate you sharing that. And it's funny, when I was in Chile, just on vacation, back when Trump had just gotten elected, I had a layover in Asuncion, which is the capital of Paraguay. And I stayed with this young, smart couple in an Airbnb. And they took me to the Paraguay's president's house, and they were like, yeah, he's a former drug dealer and this and that. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. He's like, oh, it's pretty common for South America. And they go, by the way, congratulations on President Trump. You have your first South American president, you know, with like the controversies and all that stuff.
He lined his pockets in the presidency, and he's lining his pockets, not in the presidency, but getting these donations, and he's using the donations to pay his legal expenses and so forth and so on. And, you know, listen, we've become very cynical in the society now. 40% of the registered voters are independents now. But there's something really telling going on. There's 144 million people. I'm going to say that again. There's 144 million people, Brendan Burns, that do not vote. Yeah. Okay. I just want you to think about that. Okay. So that is the largest voting bloc by far. We have less people voting, meaning we have less than the majority of the people voting deciding these elections. And the Republicans and the Democrats want it that way. They believe that their oligarchy can stay in place, this oligarchic duopoly can stay in place as long as they keep lots and lots of people who are primarily centrist from voting.
Yeah. Well, I read a stat that said 24% of America voted for Trump, you know, in the last election that he won, which is interesting because so like 50% don't vote.
Right.
You know, the other side got 26.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. 53% don't vote.
Yep.
47% voted. And there you go. You know, exactly. That's the stats. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. But hey, what I find most interesting about your story is actually what you've done in finance. I worked in investment banking at Lazard, and I worked at a smaller hedge fund when I was in New York. You know, obviously big question I'm asking quickly, but it's like, what do you think enabled you to be so successful in that space?
Persistence, intellectual curiosity. I didn't fit in, Brendan, because you know the space, so I didn't fit in. So what do I mean by that? I was this was like aristocrats, upper class people. I was a blue collar kid that hustled my way into Tufts and Harvard. I had a ton of school debt. I wasn't dressed properly. These guys were wearing Brooks Brothers from New York City. I was wearing like Cy Sims polyester from Long Island. You said you grew up on Long Island, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I was a fish out of water. But persistence, intellectual curiosity, failing upward, and I think you have to fail upward, frankly, if you want to be successful, meaning, you know, you get fired, you pick yourself up, you dust yourself off. You're in a bad trade, you lose 20% of your fund, you get back in the game and you try again. You know, you if you're at a place like Lazard and you miss the investment banking mandate, you lock and load and try to find the next investment banking mandate. And I've been doing that my whole career. So some of my career has been fantastic. I'm not this humble braggart. I'll brag about the things that I've done well. And some of my career has been a disaster. You know, I got fired from the White House. I got torched in 2008. And I talk about this, but it's so long ago. It doesn't really matter anymore. I got fired from Goldman. You know, I was fired from Goldman 18 months after I got hired. The investment bank fired me. The sales and trading area rehired me. So if you look at my resume, it looks like I was there for 7 years, but I actually got fired from the first job there. So. And I tell people about it because I want young people to know that you can have bad situations. You can have things happen to you that you really wish didn't happen to you. And if you and I were talking 35 short years ago when I was 25, I would have told you my career is going to be perfect. I was a 25-year-old naive nut job. I thought my career was going to go up in a right angle, 45 degree angle up and to the right. And I was going to make every decision properly and nothing was going to happen bad to me. And I wasn't going to have any trials or tribulations.
Yeah.
This is how stupid I was as a human being. And of course, as soon as you start your job, you get cracked in the face And then it's like, okay, how do I respond to that?
Yeah, that's good. When you first got to Harvard Law School, kind of with the background you had, was it this like surreal big experience for you? Was it, oh, this isn't actually a big deal once you got settled in? What was that like?
I was wildly intimidated. So to say intimidated wouldn't be enough. I'd have to say wildly intimidated. So I'm going to set the scene for you. I went to Tufts. It's 2 miles from Harvard, but it's thousands and thousands of miles metaphorically. You know, it's just a totally different school. Yeah. I used to drive into Harvard Square and look at awe at this Ivy League college, this, I mean, I'm not talking about the new woke Harvard. I'm talking about the 1980s version of Harvard, this august and this illustrious place. And I was like, oh, wow. I mean, this is unbelievable. I wonder if I could get into this law school. I had no chance of getting into the undergrad. And so when I got into the law school, I took the train or the bus back. I took the bus actually to the Harvard with $250 in cash. I mean, this is how crazy this stuff is. Okay. So they said, you've been accepted to Harvard Law School. In order to keep your spot, you have to bring a $250 to make the you know, to, you know, as like a deposit.
Yeah.
I went there with $250 in cash. I took it out of my Bay Banks account with like my ATM. I didn't have a checking book at the time. And the woman's like, you know, we need a check. I was like, oh, I don't have a check. I went to the post office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and got a money order.
Money order.
Okay. I mean, this is what we're talking about, right? So for me, it was naive city. I was a fish out of water. I was incredibly, and when I say incredibly, I was incredibly intimidated by the place. And then I started meeting people, and then I started meeting professors. And then I think I took my first test. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm okay here. I can do this. These people are very, very smart, and there's a ton of people smarter than me. One of the best things that can happen to you in life is work with people that are smarter than you, or study with people that are smarter than you, because it's humbling. You can drop your ego down a few notches when you're, you know, if you're in the presence of Elon Musk and he's explaining rocket science.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm good. This guy's a genius. I'm not. You know what I mean? And so there was some of that. I'm not going to say that there wasn't. But there was also some of, hey, you know, I'm here and I deserve to be here and let's make a go of it.
Yeah, no, I love that. When you were there, were you considering, first of all, why did you go to law school? And second of all, was it a hard decision to pass on big law or that sort of legal pathway versus going into finance?
So, you know, this is the truth. I went to work in between Tufts and Harvard. And so, again, we're talking about super naive time in my life. They were paying Wall Street lawyers $65,000 a year. They're now paying them $250,000, but back then, $65,000 was a lot of money. My dad was a construction worker. He's making $32,000 a year. And I was like, oh, my God, if I could make $65,000 a year, that's like more money than my parents are making. So I went to law school. I got accepted. I then said, okay, I want to work on Wall Street because this is where the Wall Street lawyers make money. I didn't realize the lawyers were all over the city. Yeah. I thought they worked on Wall Street. Okay, so I paid the $250. Then I went to the career area at Harvard. I walked in there and the woman behind the counter, I said, listen, I said, I just got accepted and I need a job for the summer. And can you tell me some of the law firms that recruit here? And she said, okay, yeah, no problem. She handed me this gigantic phone book. Now it's like in a database, a computer database. It was a big phone book. And she said, these are the law firms that recruit here. I said, okay, great. And then I asked her for the alumni directory. And so now I sat down. She said, you can't leave. I said, no problem. I sat down. I opened up the book. And I looked for law firms that were on Wall Street, actually on Wall Street.
Yeah.
And then I looked up the names of the firms, and then I looked up the names of the people in the alumni directory that worked at those firms.
Right.
I typed up my resume on a Panasonic electric typewriter. I sent my resume to those people, and then I got on the train, and I went down to Wall Street, and I went to One Wall Street, right? That's the first building on Wall Street. There was a law firm on the 28th floor called Hughes, Hubbard, and Reed. I rode the elevator up. There was no security, pre-9/11, 1986. I had my Panasonic typewritten resume. I got to the front desk, and the woman said, "Can I help you?" I said, "Yes, I'm here to see like Worthington Babscom, the 32nd, or some guy like that." And she says, "Does he know you're coming?" And I lied. I said, yes, he knows that I'm coming. You please tell him I'm Anthony Scaramucci from the Harvard Law School. She said, okay. So his assistant came out and she says, "I don't think Mr. Babscom, you know, knows who you are." I said, "Well, so-and-so, the guidance placement office suggested I come down to see him." So he comes out of his office. He's wearing these suspenders. I mean, they were talking some old school. He had pipe. I mean, people were smoking in these pipes. Yeah. He had a pipe in his hand. He looks at me and I looked at him. He said, "Okay, come back." And I go, "Man, we're sitting in the thing." And I had my resume with me, smoking a pipe, rigging my resume. And I said, "Sir, I need a job." I said, I, it's too expensive for me to go to this school. I need a job." He's smoking this pipe and he looks at me and he says, "Okay, do you want to work as a paralegal here for the summer?" I said, "Yes, I do." He says, "Okay, we got a lot of work to do. You spend a lot of time here. We're going to pay you $8 an hour." That was a lot, by the way. Okay, because minimum wage at that time was $3.35, and so this was a, you know, it was a good wage. And I looked at him. I said, "Sir, could we make it 10?"
You and had he some looks balls, at, man.
Yeah, he looks at me. He goes, "Can we make it 10? I said, "I wouldn't ask." I said, "But I have no money.
Yeah.
It's going to cost me $30,000 to go to this school next year.
Right.
And I got to take out school loans, and this could really help me." And he looks at me and goes, "You know what? We'll make it 10. And I worked my ass off for that man. Okay. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago, but he was one hell of a guy. And anyway, his name was Norm Eisenberg, by the way. I was cheesing, but worrying, but yeah. He was just one hell of a guy, and he was a terrific man. I worked my ass off for him. And long story short, I must have gotten paid $15,000 or $16,000, and I used all of that to go to the school, you know, but it got me away from the law because I didn't really like the work. And so that's the reason why I went into investment banking and not law school. I'm sorry it was so long-winded, but because I know your show, and I want to explain to your viewers and listeners the rites of passage, the foibles, the insecurities, the sensitivities, you know.
Yeah, no, I so appreciate that.
With some level of authenticity, not the bullshit story. Like, I hate these stories where I did everything perfect, every decision was right, and all this stuff, and then no one learns anything, you know? You got to create space for people to fail, to retinker, reload, adapt themselves, and know that they can get there if the first try didn't work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just the way you laid that out was so helpful. And I actually worked at Cravath for a summer and had a very similar experience with a lot of these guys with the backgrounds and whatever. But I also found that most of these people, whether it was in banking or in big law, were genuine good people that were hardworking and decent. And I remember when the 08 crash happened, everyone was like, "Occupy Wall Street." I felt there was some unfair negativity towards some of these good professionals. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Yeah, well, listen, I worked on one. I think the issue was, and I don't think we ever really did a good job of explaining this to people or created any sense of fairness. I think the issue was, okay, so wait a minute. I lost my money in the 2008 crisis. I may have been overlevered in my house. I lost my house. But the bankers on Wall Street who also misplayed the markets, and they had mortgage-backed securities that were misrated by the rating agencies, and they lost a tremendous amount of money. You guys bailed them out. But you didn't bail out me and my family, but you bailed out that bank. That bank, Goldman Sachs, could have traded its equity to zero. But my family got hurt. It looks like those guys didn't get hurt. And I think it made a lot of people upset. And we never explained to people why they were bailed out. And we never explained to people the unfairness of it, frankly. But why, if you didn't bail them out, you would have led to 25, 30% unemployment and a real full-blown economic crisis in the country. So it was a scary time. I lost a lot of money then. I went to work at Goldman. You mentioned that. I started Oscar Capital. I sold Oscar Capital to Neuberger Berman, which was a New York-based money manager. Neuberger sold itself to Lehman Brothers. And so I was at Lehman Brothers for 2 years. I left Lehman to start SkyBridge. If you told me the day I left Lehman to start SkyBridge, there would be a massive financial crisis 3 years after I started the firm, Lehman would go out of business and somehow SkyBridge would survive, I never would have bet that. You know, I thought Lehman was a fortress and I respected them and I thought they were very well run. And the reason I'm bringing all this up is that we just don't know, you know, and we have to always be careful. I always tell people that the risks are our certainty. Our certainty is our risk. So if I'm certain that Lehman's not going to go out of business, I'll have 100% of my net worth in it, right? If I'm certain Bitcoin's going up, I have 100% of my net worth in it. But so it's the things that we're certain about that hurt us the most. The things that we're worried about, we're like, oh, okay, I'm worried about this, so let me do this, or I'm worried about that, let me put money over here or there. And it's the things that we think we know with 100% certainty that we actually don't know.
Right.
It's the things that get us in the most trouble. You see what I mean? And my life, I've had a series of humbling events. I've been humbled by life itself. I've been humbled by markets. And so I don't sit here trying to pretend I have the answers. I'm going to do my best to guess at what I think is right. I'm going to give you an explanation why I think what I think. But I'm also going to caveat it with, you know, I have been wrong many times before. I've had myself in situations that I wish I hadn't been in due to overconfidence or to a misunderstanding of something.
Right. Do you feel like kind of the background that you had, Long Island, what your parents did, Tufts background, actually gave you more advantages than the average person at Goldman to either be more willing to start a fund, more willing to kind of get your hands dirtier, be scrappier, be more relentless?
It's a really good question. And I think the experience at Goldman and the firing that I had from Goldman and then the rehiring did make me scrappier. It was a little silly, Goldman, in some ways. And what I mean by that is it was silly in the sense that I was making such good money, Brendan, in the mid-90s, that to leave Goldman was a sign of stupidity. But I believed in my heart always that I needed to have my own business and I needed to control my own destiny. And so, yes, Goldman prepared me for all that stuff. But I was scrappy as a kid. You know, I had a paper route. I was working in a butcher store. I worked in a grocery store. I worked for my uncle's motorcycle shop, delivering motorcycles. When I got to Tufts, I was delivering pizzas to my fellow students. I had no shame. You know, whatever I needed to do to make things happen, I was going to make them happen. And so I knew that I needed to start my own business, because if I didn't start my own business, what was going to end up happening is I was going to get meleed at one of these firms. One of my mentors who I adore is a guy named Mario Gabelli. And since you've worked on Wall Street, you may know him. He's an Italian billionaire, self-made man who built a nice big asset management company for himself. And Mario said to me when I was 31, he said, "Hey, Goldman is a great place, but by the time you're 50, you're going to be a really old man at Goldman. They like 25, 30, 45-year-olds. They don't like 50-year-olds or 60-year-olds. And they're going to cut you. And you'll be better off leaving now, starting your own business, because someday you're going to be 50 and you're going to want to work. You're going to have a lot of energy. You're going to want to work." Now I'm 60, Brendan. And he was totally right, because having my own business has given me this platform to work off of. Yeah. And if I had stayed at Goldman, I would have definitely gotten dislodged there. And again, I'm not taking it personally. That's just what they do.
Yeah. I mean,
You're almost term limited at these places. Does that make sense?
I think in general, it makes sense. Like any company, organization, look at corporate America too, right? They move out the old folks, they bring in the new. But I also feel like there's so many just lifestyle and financial benefits to being a business owner in this country, right? Like the tax benefits, the lifestyle, yes. The hours, mm-hmm.
yes.
Not having, so I never wanted to have someone be able to say, hey, Brandon, you have to sit in this room and you're not allowed to go home. I just want that freedom, but everyone's got their own reasons.
Yes. Well, I mean, here's the thing though, this is the other irony, right? My dad, may his soul rest in peace, was a wonderful guy, died last September, but he was a working man, and he didn't have an understanding of white collar America, corporate America. We weren't members of a country club, nothing like that. And I said to my dad, I'm leaving Goldman, Dad, because it's a political place, and I'm going to create a place that has no politics. I'm going to be my own boss. I'm going to control my own destiny. It's like, oh, great, son, whatever you think. It was very supportive, right? But when I left Goldman, you have 10 people in a room, you got politics, Brendan,
Yeah.
And you don't control your own destiny because your destiny is tied to your clients.
Clients, yeah.
An entrepreneur is a guy that works 90 hours a week for freedom. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and by the way, this one more quick story. I was doing well in the beginning, and I had a couple of my Goldman friends come over to my office, and they're like, oh, I'm going to go leave and start my own business. You're doing great, and I'm going to leave and start my own business. And I looked at one of these guys. I said, hey, can I show you my Hamptons house? And he said, well, what do you mean? I said, I want to show you my Hamptons house. Can I show it to you? He's like, sure. I said, okay, get up, come on. And I walked him down the hall of my office, and I opened up the server door, and I had about $1 million. And this was 1997, it was a lot of money. Had $1 million of computer servers, these old fashioned servers that we used to do trades and process trades. And I said, okay, that's my Hamptons house. I.e., I don't have a Hamptons house. Okay. I had to put the money in the closet into the computer system to run the business. And I said, if you're willing to put your Hamptons house in the closet, because if you are, you should come and start your own business.
Right.
But if you want to be at those cocktail parties in the Hamptons impressing your friends, you can't. I mean, maybe you can. Maybe you're richer than me. But I'm saying, this is my Hamptons house. You like it? And then I closed the server door.
Well, it sounds like you've always been willing to make sacrifices for the benefit of your future.
Always.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, and here's the other thing, you know, when I turned 60, my oldest son turned to me and he said, Dad, what have you learned? And I said, you know what I've really learned? That the money is very dangerous. The money is very dangerous. Elon Musk talks about the woke mind virus, and we could talk about that. But there's also another virus. It's called affluenza. Affluent, right? But affluenza.
Right.
It's a take on affluenza, right? But it's affluent affluenza, right?
Like money flu.
The money flu. And what's the money flu? I'm smarter than you. I have more money than you, so I'm smarter than you. I have more money than you, so that I'm better than you. I have more money than you, so you know what? Don't you have to look up to me and you have to kiss my butt, and I have to look down on you and be patronizing to you. And I watch this time and time again with people. I'm a blue collar kid from Long Island. I'm from a working class family. Yes, I've made some good money, and yes, I'm financially independent, but I live 2 miles from my parents. I also, or now my mom, I also know the paradox of wealth. So wealthy people are generally lonely. And hear me out for a second. I've got a huge house on 15 acres. Okay, well, now there's nobody around you.
Yeah.
I'm flying privately. Oh, okay, great. Now you never go into an airport, or you never travel on Delta.
Yeah.
You're by yourself in the plane. Oh, I've got a yacht. All right. Well, you're not on the cruise ship with the hoi polloi. You understand what I'm saying? And the weird thing about the wealth, it's so separating that it makes you solitary, makes you lonely. You know, I live in a suburban house on a nondescript street in Manhasset, Long Island. It's a nice house. You can tell it's, you know, even just from this office I'm in, it's got nice furnishings and it's got a nice set of technology and stuff like that. But it's not a 15-acre mansion in the middle of nowhere. I want my kids, when they come into the house, if they've got friends next door, they go over to the next door neighbor. They eat a bowl of cereal, or they walk in and out of each other's houses. I don't want them living like they're nuts, right? And then also, my buddies that are so rich, they're so effing arrogant. Yeah. Now, you mentioned Bo Dietl being on your podcast. He's like my guy, you know? He's a down-to-earth guy, you know? That's the people I want to hang out with. If you're talking down to me because you got billions and I don't quite have your money, all right, I'm sorry. You know, I got no time for you.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? But the flip side is I got time for the bologna slicer because he could actually even be related to me. And I want to make sure that he doesn't feel that I think I'm better than him, because I'm not.
There's a Ralph Waldo Emerson quote: every man is my superior in some way. And in that, I learn of him.
I mean, it's a brilliant quote. I have to see if I can remember, or maybe you can text it to me after our podcast, because it's a brilliant quote, you know. And I had this weird thing happen to me this week, but I'm going to share it on your podcast. I used to go to the Harvard Club when I left Goldman, because I'm such an insecure jackass, or at least at that time. I joined the Harvard Club. So if I took Brendan to breakfast, I'd say, let's meet at the Harvard Club. And this way you would know I went to Harvard, you know, because I was no longer working at Goldman. So I needed to try to impress you, right? And it was all Latin guys in there working, right? Yeah. And they were all buds of mine. You know, hey, Mr. Anthony, you want the espresso, this, that, and the other thing, okay? And so every day for like 4 years, I used to eat breakfast there. I'd tip everybody, take everybody. And I'd meet potential clients and prospects, right? This guy, Joaquin, who's serving me the cappuccino, he walks over to me. He says, Mr. Anthony. I said, yes. He says, you manage money? I said, yes. He says, okay. He says, you know, Mr. Anthony, he said, it's a terrible tragedy. He said, my son got blinded in a factory accident. Wasn't his fault. We hired a plaintiff's attorney and we sued, and he made $35 million in the settlement after we paid the plaintiff's attorney. Again, this was like 2003, right? And he turns to me and he says, would you manage the money? And I looked at him and said, well, first of all, I'm so sorry this happened to your son, but I actually can't manage that money because I'm not the right guy for this. But I referred him to the right person for this. And I tell people, there I am hosting people, trying to meet prospects. One of the biggest prospects, Brendan, was the busboy.
Yeah.
So you got to be, what Ralph Waldo Emerson says, you got to be nice to people, right? He's like, you're a good guy, and I know you'll take care of my family. And by the way, the person I referred him to did take care of the family. He still has the money there. And unfortunately, this man died about 6 months ago. Right. And on time, he died young. He was like only 55. But his family's very well taken care of, and the son has got the right care. But the guy that was serving the cappuccino was the biggest prospect in the room, Brendan.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So be nice to people. Be nice to people. There's no reason not to be. Treat the people that are serving you a meal with dignity, grace, and kindness.
Is that a cultural thing you got from your dad or your parents?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was from my mother, really, more than anybody, you know, because my grandmother was a maid. She got here from Italy. She couldn't get a job. Yeah. And so she ended up turning beds in people's houses, cleaning their homes. Yeah. And I always leave extra money in every hotel room because I'm like, this could be somebody's grandmother here. This could be my nana. And so I'm like, okay, leaves extra money. not better than this person. Let's make sure that we're looking out for people, you know? And I think I got that from my mother. Yeah, no question. My mother was always like, you know, but here's the other thing. Okay, and this is for all your viewers and listeners too. You know better, but you know worse than anybody either. Don't let people talk down to you. You know better, but you know worse. You know, and you are entitled to be treated. If you're also entitled to be treated with dignity and kindness.
So what does that look like? You're a man of many great stories, if you have a story, or just in general, how does that play out in your life? And like when someone tries to put you down, you're like, no, I'm not going to allow that.
Yeah, no. I mean, that was happening with me and Trump. Trump started like going off on me and my wife on Twitter. I'm like, this guy's nuts. I'm not going to let him do that.
Yeah.
I'm not Ted Cruz. I'm going to like lay down and let the guy walk over me. It's just not going to happen, you know? Or if I was in a situation, you know, I fired clients. Like, excuse me? You're not allowed to talk to me like that. I'm sorry. Well, I've got my money with you. Well, you're not going to have your money with me after this meeting. We're going to move the money. You know, I had a situation where I'm like the membership chair of a private club in New York City. I walked into the locker room and these two brothers were demeaning the locker attendant. I looked at these guys. I said, excuse me, that's how you're talking to the locker attendant? I said, let me tell you, when you talk to the locker attendant like that one more time, I'm going to get a green garbage bag. I'm going to open your locker. I'm going to throw everything in the green garbage bag, and I'm going to throw it into 54th Street. You're not allowed to talk to the guy like that. Straighten yourself out immediately.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, I would rather lose friends over that because they're not your friends, man. They're not.
Yep.
Okay. And if they're being mean-spirited or they're talking to people indignantly, it probably is a sign of their personal insecurities or it's a sign of their false superiority. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So you would agree, because I'm doing this too in my life, having fewer, healthier, better friends, clients.
Less is more, my man.
Yeah.
Less is more. Let me tell you something. Less is more in so many different ways. All right, one more story, because you got me on a story roll, if you don't mind, okay?
One more, Anthony, do it.
I was working with this lawyer before, you know, I left law school, right? So my first job was with the paralegal. Then my second job after my first year was like with a solo practitioner. And he was paying me good money, and he was a very rich guy. And I was at his house in the Hamptons. It's 1987. I'm 23 years old. I'm at his house in the Hamptons. Beautiful house, like swimming pools and like pool, you know, like tennis courts. And he's like, hey, he goes, you know, I grew up with no money because now I got money. It's good. Don't get me wrong. It's good. He said, but you know what I really want to do? I want to go cook. He was an Italian guy. I want to cook a pot of pasta, put some sauce on it, watch television, eat the pasta and go to sleep.
Yeah.
And I said to that son of a bitch, again, made his soul recipe, another great guy. I said, that's because you got money. I don't have any money. So you see, you're saying that, and I'm anxious. I'm afraid about paying my bills. I'm afraid about making it. And I don't have any money. And you're just saying that because you're a lucky son of a bitch. You're like the fox that caught the grapes, and the grapes weren't sour, right?
Yeah.
And he said, you just wait, Scaramucci. You just wait. And he was right. Brendan, he was right. He was right. Okay. Yes, it's good to have money and it's good to have some financial security, but dial it in, my brother. Dial it in to your closest friends, your closest relationships, the places you like to go where you're treated well, you know, and we are suffering in the society now from a lot of splintering and a lot of loneliness, and we're suffering from a lot of feedback loops, algorithmic feedback loops. So if I go on Twitter and I'm interested in something, guess what they do? They keep showing me the stuff that I'm interested in. Same thing with the television channels, and same thing with the podcast, and same thing with the other social media outlets, you know?
Yeah.
And you got to be careful. Other thing is that these young kids are looking at filtered lives.
It's not real.
And they're looking at a filtered life and they're living an unfiltered life. So they're like, oh, you know, this girl's got no cellulite, or this girl's got no fat, or this girl's that, or this guy's this, or this guy's, you know, time out. Everybody's got problems. They're human beings. Everybody's living an unfiltered life. Relax and enjoy your life. And don't worry about what the other people thinking. And you build that small, close circle of friends, you're just going to be so much happier.
Yeah. I also love what you said about how kind of most people just optimize for wealth accumulation, which then turns into like your own big house, your own big every, and it's all alone. You're just.
Oh, what? I mean, you're designed to be social, man.
Yeah.
I want the kids in and out of the house. You know, I did do this though. Okay. And my wife was like, you're a bit of an idiot, but I did it anyway. Now she's had to admit, and it's rare, but she had to admit that I was right. Okay. I built the kids this like little bunker. So they have a little gaming room and they have like a little indoor hoop. And I'm not talking about like a Nerf hoop, you know, and I got, you know, a dartboard you could shoot at, but not with the needles, you know, like the suction darts. And young kids. And I said, trust me, they're going to invite their friends over here. I want my kids here in my house with their friends, you know. You know, when they're over at other people's, I get a little anxious. I'm like a Jewish grandmother. You know, I get a little anxious. But they're over here. I can keep an eye on them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, but they're over, and they're socializing, and they're eating, and they're throwing barbecue chicken wings on the floor. You know, God bless.
Yeah.
Or you want, what do you want to do? You want to be in a 15-acre mansion with a maid and a butler and the kid's Richie Rich and he's got no friends? I'm not up for that. I don't like it.
No, me either, man. I love everything you're saying. This is like an instant re-listen for me this weekend. This is like a free coaching session, so I love it.
Well, it's just an observation. It's a 60-year observation of being on a planet, you know? It's just my observation, you know? And I'm, yeah. And by the way, here's the other thing. I gave a speech at Yale this week, and I told these kids that the optic nerf, which, you know, is sending a signal from your camera, also known as your eye, it's beaming a picture of what's going on the earth through the optic nerve. And the optic nerve is just less on average than 2 millimeters wide. So Brendan, Anthony, you pick the person, their entire view of this vast universe is coming through a piece of wire that's this big, this wide. So from a perception point of view, you may be missing things, right? You may not be able to see everything. Okay, so be humble about your perceptions as well. So I'm not here, I hope to God I didn't come across as overly declarative on your podcast. I am just here making my observation based on my perception. And but I'm also not judging other people's observation or other people's perceptions. You want to live in that big house with the 15 acres and a maid and have your kid be Richie Rich, no problem. But be nice to the maid and make sure if my son or me show up, you know, don't lord over me and try to pretend that you're better than me because you're actually not better than me. And it's just annoying.
Yeah.
Right. And the flip side is if a kid comes into my house and he may be coming to a house from a, you know, of less means, you better make sure we're treating that kid terrifically in this house. You see what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean,
but I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just giving you my 2 millimeter width observation of what's going on.
Well, I think it's fantastic observations from someone who's had a lot of success, has been through a lot, very humble, very insightful. Before we, I know we got to wrap up here, but just tell us quickly about your new book and you know, what it's about and where people can grab it.
So my new book is called From Wall Street to the White House and Back. It's available where books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, local bookstores. I also do a podcast called Open Book where I interview authors. And so I've got a whole list of best-selling authors that will come onto my podcast, which is a lot of fun for me because I love reading and I do enjoy writing. And I tell people, please read books. It used to be, for $10 and 10 hours, you can get 10 years of education. But we got inflation in this country. So it's $30, 10 hours, you can get 10 years of education. And these authors, and I've got a lot of books in my house for a reason because I read them. And these authors are working on these books for years and they're distilling things for you. And I try to write an honest story about the trials and tribulations of getting fired from the White House, returning to Skybridge, riding the comet up and down of the cryptocurrency markets. And I try to write a lot of truths in the book, and some of it doesn't reflect well on me, and some of it is a case study in resilience. And so anyway, it's a short book. I didn't even write it in chapters, Brent. I wrote it in lessons, because I figure we all have such short attention spans now. You know, these are 3 to 5 page lessons, and you could start in the middle of the book, end of the book, beginning of the book, and you can find something in there.
Love that. And, you know, obviously you've shared so much value today. And for me, at least, and I'm sure for our listeners who've enjoyed this episode, it just is a natural progression to go grab that book on Amazon or wherever books are sold. So, yeah, man, I'll hit you up. And thanks so much for coming on the show. This was awesome. And so many good lessons in here. And I love how you've taken what you've been through and really turned it into good. And you're sharing it with people.
You're the man.
Awesome.
All right, brother. Be well. All right.
You too. Thanks for your time, man.
Thank you for having me. Stay in touch, please.
For sure.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Brendan Burns Show. If it's your first time here, please make sure to subscribe on the Apple Podcasts app or in Spotify. Also, please leave us a rating or written review. This helps others learn about the show and spread the word to new and more people. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day.